Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So, yeah, welcome. How many of you have read this book, Mind and Cosmos by Thomas Nagel? So, okay, about 25%, I would say, or let's say 20%. I think it's an interesting book, but as you read it, you might not understand everything at once, and I don't claim to have understood him completely. I think it's a very concise book, and of course a very controversial book. So I will give a small introduction, and then we will exploratively walk through the book, because most of the reviews of the book are very short or just pick out some things, and I want to try to give you the whole view of the book and not just picking out what I like and what I don't like and so on. And then we will have a discussion about the positive aspects, the negative aspects, the things that have been criticized and those that have been valued by different people and its usefulness maybe in our scientific apologetics. And this can all be debated, of course. So Thomas Nagel, he was born in 1937 in Belgrade in Yugoslavia, and he comes from a Jewish family. It's so interesting that often the most controversial people who really contribute new thoughts are often from a Jewish background. I don't know where that comes from, but it's very interesting. Just like Albert Einstein and other people. He studied at Cornell, Oxford, Harvard. He taught at Berkeley and Princeton. So I don't know what's missing there. And now he's a professor of philosophy and law, emeritus actually, at New York University. His most important works are The Possibility of Altruism, and then 1974, most people might have heard about that work, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, where he argues that actually our subjective experience, even that of a bat, is not reducible, and we can never know how a bat really feels. And not only a bat, but all the penguins and other beings as well. So, in 2012, he released the book Mind and Cosmos by the materialist neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. Of course, this is already, by design, a very controversial and provocative title. It's only 130 pages. When you think about the title, Mind and Cosmos, you might expect a volume like that and having 800 pages, but it's just like that. And he attacks actually really a ruling paradigm as he sees it. And he, as a philosopher, takes on naturalistic scientists on philosophical grounds, actually. And so he caused a lot of turmoil. You could say it's the Nagelian explosion, so to say. Like the Chronicle of Higher Education commented, quoted Steven Pinker. He said, the shoddy reasoning of a once great thinker. So thank you for your contributions, but that's it now. Or Daniel Dennett says, he's a member of a retrograde gang whose work isn't worth anything. It's cute and it's clever, but it's not worth a damn. I could quote many other things like that. It really caused turmoil. And in Germany, it was not received as controversial as in the Anglo-American world, I realized. For example, the Catholic Academy organized a symposium in Berlin on perspectives after Thomas Nagel. So they tried to engage with it constructively. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to join that. It would have been interesting who contributes and what they think about that. But we'll come back to that later. He himself says that his book, in the preface, was stimulated in different ways, mainly by Sharon Street, we will come to her later, and Roger White, and a research group on science and religion at the New York Institute of Philosophy that had courses running from 2006 to 2009. So he somehow summarizes and condenses what they discussed in these 3 to 4 years. And he thanks particularly to 8 people, among them Alvin Plantinga, the famous Christian philosopher, whom many of you might have heard of already. And he actually excuses, in view of the unorthodoxy of the result, I hope these thanks will not give offense. So he's well aware of what he's doing, I feel. Okay, let's come to the introduction. What's that all about? It's about a serious problem. He says, the aim of this book is to argue that the mind-body problem is not just a local problem having to do with the relation between mind, brain, and behavior in living animal organisms, but that this problem invades our understanding of the entire cosmos and the history of the cosmos. It's not just about us, but about the whole of the universe. We need to acknowledge the limits of what is actually understood and recognize what can and cannot, in principle, be understood by certain existing methods. So it's also epistemological questions and issues at stake. What can science do and what can it not do and explore? He's arguing against a comprehensive, speculative world picture, a particular naturalistic Weltanschauung, he uses a German word there. Such a worldview is not a necessary condition of the practice of any of those in sciences, and its acceptance or non-acceptance would have no effect on most scientific research. So he distinguishes between different worldviews that scientists have, and he says actually no matter what they believe when they do science, this does not really play a role in most of anything that has been done in scientific research. So you shouldn't exclude people with a different worldview. But among the scientists and philosophers, reductive materialism is widely assumed to be the only serious possibility. And that's what really gets him angry. So what's his starting point in his argument? It's actually two failures of the toe, of the theory of everything, which is currently held. And he says the first failure is the one of psychophysical reductionism. It's a philosophical question. So mind is an essential phenomenon in our universe, and it cannot be reduced to physics. So could it be that it cannot be reduced to physics because the considered processes that we consider to be explanations are incomplete and we need more and new processes and new pictures? And the second failure is that of physico-chemical reductionism, which is an empirical question, the chemical basis for life and the genetic code. He says it's highly implausible. The probability is far too small for self-reproducing life to come into existence in the history of the universe. So he says that all this is just the product of governing assumptions that are unsupported, and it flies in the face of common sense when you look at these problems. Can't you read it? Can we lift that up somehow? Because I often have the slides full of text like that. Okay, so, and he says that actually, taking point number two, most scientists would agree that this is really a difficult problem and is not easily solved. And right now we don't have a solution to that question, how life came into existence. With regard a second problem comes in, and that is the one of sources of variation in the evolutionary process. He says that the likelihood within the available geological timescale, and if you just take it as a result of physical accident and chance, the likelihood that a sequence of viable genetic mutations should have occurred that was sufficient to permit natural selection to produce the organisms that actually exist, this likelihood is much too small. And he says that this problem actually is often underestimated on the basis of assumptions that are used to interpret the indirect evidence for this history of life from the first start of life, which was problem number one, to the variety of life. And he says, my skepticism is not based on religious belief, but on common sense, on page number 7. He even admits that he is stimulated by intelligent design. He quotes Michael Behe and Stephen Meyer, and he says, they are motivated at least in part by their religious beliefs. Their empirical arguments are of great interest. So he doesn't think that to be motivated by religious belief is a good thing, but their empirical arguments have to be taken seriously. And he comments David Berlinsky because he does not make any reference to design, but still deconstructs evolutionary theory. The problems that these iconoclasts, that's how he calls them, pose for the orthodox scientific consensus should be taken seriously. They do not deserve the scorn with which they are commonly met. It is manifestly unfair. So he really sticks out his head quite far out of the window. But he also pulls back again and says, I confess to an ungrounded assumption of my own, which I think is a very honest statement to say such a thing, in not finding it possible to regard the design alternative as a real option. I lack the sensus divinitatis, so the awareness of a god, that enables so many people to see in the world the expression of divine purpose, page number 12. In the footnote, he adds, I am not just unreceptive, but strongly averse to the idea, as I have said elsewhere. So he wants to prevent to be misinterpreted on that. The defenders of intelligent design deserve our gratitude for challenging a scientific worldview that owes some of the passion displayed by its adherents precisely to the fact that it is thought to liberate us from religion. So he sees somehow that the materialist neo-Darwin conception of nature is actually aimed at religion and not just only on exploring nature. There is a hidden agenda behind that, in his view. So what about that now? And he says, we will go for another project, and he calls it the anti-reductionist project. And he says there are two premises that go into this new paradigm that he suggests. One is the existence of mind is too remarkable to be regarded as just an accident in the universe. It must have a cause why mind came about. It's not just an accident of the universe. And number two, the ideal of discovering a single unifying natural order on basis of a set of common elements and principles. So we don't want to have two natures or anything interfering with nature, but nature is and remains a single unified order. And an order that can be discovered by human beings who have mind again. And so he says, with regard to number one, materialism fails to recognize this, and it can't explain mind in spite of great success, for example, in cosmology and so on. But it simply fails to explain mind. So these are the two failures of the theory of everything that I just mentioned before. And with regard to number two, he says that theism or Cartesian dualism are just incompatible with a unified natural order. So you should not use these alternatives. We need an inherent picture, an immanent picture, which means that new natural guiding principles are necessary, which are not derived from timeless laws of physics, but it must be guiding principles that change over time. So, this is the introduction, which I took a lot of time to do because it sets the whole picture so that you can understand what this book is all about. So, in chapter number two, he goes about to explain his new paradigm. He says, okay, all of reality, on the one hand, we have matter, physics, chemistry, biology, deal with that in a unified mathematical order, or beyond mathematics even, descriptive order. But then we also have mind, consciousness, meaning, purpose, intentionality, thought, reasons, beliefs, desires, value, qualia. In a universe of only facts, is that possible? Can the universe just be facts or must it be more? He says it must be more. In materialism, reductionism is implied. Because if everything is matter, then you can reduce everything to matter. And this fails to explain mind. So he says, biology must be physics and chemistry, yes, but it must be more. There must be an additional extra parameter to that, an additional extra principle or paradigm which explains the existence of consciousness and all these mental phenomena. And all this needs to take into account that there is a basic assumption of science that the world that we look at is intelligible by mind. And a theory of everything must include this important fact, that the world is intelligible by mind. So what is to be explained? It is to be explained that nature produces beings that are capable of comprehending themselves and nature. The universe becomes aware of itself, so to say. And materialism fails. It can't explain why our cognitive senses are reliable, because this is self-undermining. If reason is a product of irrational processes, why should we prefer reason over instinct when both are just evolved instincts? Why should we prefer one instinct over another, and so on? So there is no reason in evolution, in the materialistic evolution, that cognitive senses are reliable. But he also says that theism fails because it doesn't yield a comprehensive uniform order of nature. And both of them, of these, have no defense against skepticism in his view. Because on the one side, if evolution is true, then evolutionary fitness is the criterion for the evolution of mind. And actually, evolutionary fitness can't be the criterion for truth. So there is no reason why our mind should follow truth. On the other hand, if there is a God, we are never secure against the existence of Descartes' demon, which says that he could just invent any experience or intervene in our mind and implant any experience in our mind. He could always make fools of us and implant a view of the world, of a world that is not even there, like brains in a vat or something. So skepticism rules in these two different worldviews in his mind, in his view. So a unified natural theory must account for all of reality. Reality is matter plus biological life, organisms, plus conscious minds, plus logical, mathematical truths or reason, and plus ethical, moral truths. And all this must be explained by a theory of everything. It's chemical laws plus teleological elements or forces that interfere with matter and guide it. So, here we go. We need to think about how do we arrive at consciousness. And I represent always every chapter by a little cartoon there, and this should just show that consciousness can take different states in your mind, and these are expressed in behavior by Calvin. So the mind-body problem, what is it? On the one hand, we have the objective physical external reality. It's about shape, size, motion, everything you can measure and quantify. On the other hand, we have these subjective mental internal reality, phenomena, the internal reality of color, sound, intention. And they are dependent on physical events in the brain, as he says, but they are not reducible to that. So he says, dualism, like Descartes, he says that both of these levels of reality are real, but he has the big problem of interaction. So this can't be the solution. Because they can't interact. And you have this interaction problem between them. And Descartes thought it's the epiphysis, and this has been refuted. So there is no solution to that problem. He doesn't go into many details. He just says this is no explanation. We would have to have another talk on mind, on the mind-body problem probably to dig into that deeper. I just say what he says here. And then idealism, it's Berkeley. And he says that actually all of the physical world is the result of a mental being of God. And he says then all of materialism, of matter is just an illusion or something, which is actually in a deeper meaning, in a deeper reality rooted, which is idealism. And materialism, on the other hand, only says there is only the physical world, and this is irreducibly real. So they try to come up with behaviorism, that would be an on talk on itself, like input and output can be observed, and that's all that mind is all about. It's only about the input and the output of our behavior. Or verificationism, mental is only what can be confirmed by scientific methods. Or functionalism, that functional interaction, no matter what matter is used for that functioning, causes mind. So we have this question about artificial intelligence that we had right at the beginning of our sessions here. And he still says all these different theories, he quotes others, I think, they all fail actually, because our first person experience exists, and this is a fact that we have to take into account. Sugar tastes to you, pain hurts, you have thoughts, you are a subject experiencing things. I personally would add, I can't imagine life without me. He doesn't say that. So the question that has to be answered is, what in a physical state of the brain makes it a mental state too? How does the physical cause the mental? And he gives an explanation of a calculator. 3 plus 5, you type that into your calculator, and we hope that you come up with 8. And you could say this is just caused by the currents in the machine, in the calculator. But he says the real explanation is not the currents in the machine. It is the algorithm that controls the currents running through the machine. So actually the algorithm is intended for a purpose. There is a guiding principle behind that machine, and that's why it comes up with the same result. If it came up by number 7, the physics would still be all right. Just the metaphysics would not be all right, the mathematical metaphysics. And so he says, when we observe patterns, regularities, that demands an explanation. So for example, if you observe that a mother dies and the cousin of that mother dies and the sister dies, this results in a phenomenon that you would call like all female relatives die from breast cancer. I think he uses a slightly different example, but I thought this is more plausible. And all female relatives somehow died. And you need a unified explanation for that. If they all died, for example, from breast cancer. And the explanation A might be genetic disposition. And that would be the explanation why all of them died within a certain period of time, which resulted in reality C that can be observed now that all of them are dead. So now he applies that to evolutionary theory. And he says, why do conscious organisms exist? C, the reality that we can observe is consciousness of organisms exists. B would be the particular instances in which all these organisms appear. Like consciousness is also prevalent in animals. So we have different organisms that somehow come about in the history of the universe, and they appear. But in order to be an explanation for that, you need a theory A that actually accounts for that. Like the principle of a genetic disease accounts for different deaths of relatives. So he says the natural order must explain the origin of C. It just can't be taken as a brute fact. So what must be explained in that? Consciousness must increase survival if evolutionary theory works. Then the features of consciousness are somehow genetically transmitted. Third, genetic variation causes mental and physical variation. So there is a connection between the material processes, genetics, and the mental. And these mechanisms need precursors that create conditions for their possibility. So you need that already actually at the origin of life and so on. There must be some precursor that creates the conditions for their possibility. And he says, a natural order always consists of two parts. One is the part, the constitutive part, which means what's the structure? How does it work? How does it function? Mechanisms and so on. And on the other side, the historical part of the explanation, how does this structure that we observe now comes about? If you just need some break, look at Calvin and how he expresses his different mental states. So, the constitutive explanation, how is a physical system also mental? He says there are two basic possibilities. One possibility in science is to have a reductive explanation, which means that the property of the system is simply the sum of the properties of elementary constituents. Like you build a house from Lego stones. Do you have Lego stones as well? Do you know what I mean? The Danish product which is preferred by children to play. Yeah, so the physical constituents are not merely physical. They have some physical side to it, but they are more than that. So this would be the alternative of panpsychism, which means that material elements, even the elementary particles, have some mental properties. This would be number one possibility. And number two would be the emergent explanation, which would mean that the elementary constituents have not these properties, but the property of a system from complex physical higher order interaction. The property arises from the interaction in a system of complex higher order. But he says it must be more than just supervenience, like you build something together and then you have this additional property, but you don't know how that really is related. And you just say, well, it supervenes, which means it's just a brute fact. As an example, he gives the liquidity of water. He says, well, one water molecule is not liquid. It's just a molecule. But if you take several of them, then the new property of liquidity arises. But we can understand why this happens, because these molecules interact via dipolar interaction and so on. So liquidity as an emergent property is based actually on a mechanism, on an interaction that can be understood in physics. So what about consciousness? And he says that the basic mechanism is still unknown, and he doesn't have any hope that this will be discovered, and maybe it's not, it can't be known in principle. Why are certain physical states necessarily mental? So we have these two possibilities in the constitutive explanation, how that system works and comes about. And now we go to the historical explanation, and he says, which means, how did mental systems come into being in our universe? There are three possibilities in his view. First, a causal view, which would mean that causation is only happening due to law. A law-governed efficient causation, which means in the Big Bang, you come by pure natural causes to the origin of life, you arrive at biological evolution and at consciousness, either reductive or emergent. Then you have the second stance, which would be the teleological stance. He says you have additional guiding by non-elemental laws, you have natural guiding principles that are time-dependent. And he says that this is a concept also applied from Aristotle already, like a teleological force and explanation in the four causes from Aristotle. And then C, he distinguishes from the teleological stance an intentional stance, and says that the realization of constitutive conditions in natural order could also come about by divine intervention. Someone who intends it and does it, no matter what the structure of nature is. So when we sum that up, we have two constitutive stances times three historical ones, which means we have six scenarios. And I will refer to them by a code that I developed myself. It's not the most intelligent one, I could have made it differently. But I will just say A and B in the first place denote whether we go for the reductive A or the emergent B. And then the second letter will describe ABC, whether it's causal, whether it's teleological, or whether it's intentional. So he now really takes time to dig into all these six scenarios, and I will have to shorten that a bit because it becomes too complicated then. So if we take, and he starts with the emergent causal scenario, interestingly, and not sticking to his own order that he has set up, and he says, okay, what is playing a role in the emergent causal scenario? First, we have physical evolutionary history. Then second, we need a psychophysical theory, which is emergent. Emergent explains the existence of mind. And third, we need some extra ingredient. Actually, we need to understand how can we understand emergence? Like, why does water become liquid? Why does a brain cause a mind? So number one, must explain why conscious organisms were likely. Number two, must be inseparable from animal life, giving systematically rise to consciousness, providing independent causal power of conscious beings. Number three, emergence may not remain a mysterious brute fact. Emergent properties must follow systematically. So he says that emergence cannot just be a magic. It must really explain why a brain causes consciousness to arise. So a reductive causal scenario would be material elements have proto-psychic properties, like in panpsychism, and in history these parts come together. And he says there are several problems with that. How can a mental whole be constructed from mental parts? Why do certain, because all these material elements might have different mental entities to themselves or something, and how can you form a mental whole out of different mental entities that come together? How is a mind made up by elemental minds, so to say? Why do certain structures necessarily have visual experience? And he goes into that in more detail. Why can our brain actually see things? And why do we have pictures and see red and so on? How does that come about by just neurons? And he says there is a large assumption behind that. The properties of matter explain all of history of the universe. And he says this is still a problem with the likelihood of life if you remain in a purely causal scenario. So he then goes on to the intentional stance and says, okay, the answer to that, no matter whether it's reductive or emergent, in his view, it might be compatible with both. God created from proto-psychic or non-psychic elements, depending on whether you go the reductive or the emergent picture. And he also creates highly specific initial conditions. The purpose is then an outer frame, and it's not internal to nature, which, of course, destroys the unified natural order, which may not happen. And then he goes on as the alternative, the third way, so to say, with the teleological stance. And he says there is no intervention from outside, and teleological principles govern the organization over time. They are non-deterministic laws that select outcomes. And the outcomes exhibit value because of the teleology. We will go into that later when we talk about value. So he says the teleological option is in many ways obscure. He admits that. The reductive causal alternative is equally obscure. And of course, the intentional stance is also obscure. So actually, it's a choice between three obscure things and possibilities to explain all that. So to sum up the consciousness part, conscious experience is irreducible to physical and, in humans, inseparable from intentionality. Human consciousness is not merely passive, but is permeated both in action and in cognition with intentionality, the capacity of the mind to represent the world and its own aims. Dualism and theism give up on finding an integrated naturalistic explanation. Any theory of life also has to explain the development of consciousness, Any theory of life also has to explain the development of consciousness and may not make the problem worse, but will in the end contribute to the explanation. So he says, if we think about that which has to be explained and include different factors, that might even solve the life problem as well. So please, why don't you think in new ways and accept this new paradigm? Cognition is the second part, and I think you got the chapter because it's online available for free. Chapter number 4. Cognition requires consciousness. Without consciousness, you can't reason. So a computer, in his view, does not know, but a computer just follows rules, but has no experience of the logic behind that. And note, I changed the picture now. You can represent the world in your cognition. So cognition transcends consciousness, conscious experience in the following way. Experience of the immediate life world is a first-person experience, like pain, desire, color, sound, and smell. It's perception, sensation, emotion. But by cognition, we can transcend this first-person experience into objective reality of nature and value, which is a third-person experience, a scientific thing. We can distinguish between appearance, as we experience it in our first-person experience, and reality, on the other way, that can be communicated with other people. So he says there are true beliefs that are fallible or reliable, and about nature, about logic, math, mathematics, and about moral values. Reasoning or cognition is governed by norms of thought and not so much by physical processes. For example, language is needed for that and certain rules for a language. And actually, everything that has to do with cognition and reason is the basis for science, mathematics, and ethics. And if you can't explain cognition and reason and so on, and if that is just only matter, then everything is just an illusion. So there are two problems of a naturalistic explanation of the arisal of cognition. He says, first, there's the likelihood problem. How can natural selection for fitness lead to creatures with the capacity to discover truth by reason, beyond the appearances, and not just react to the appearances? You would have to construct an evolutionary scenario how you could arrive at that. And second, the nature of reason itself. We will come to that later. So, problem number one, the likelihood problem, he says, the problem arises only if we presuppose a realism about the subject matter of thought. So if you say that our thoughts actually have nothing to do with reality and with truth, you don't have a problem with that. But he says actually that our presuppositions as human beings and our perception would point into another direction. If there is no judgment-independent world or mathematics or ethics, all is only human construction, which is anti-realism. But this seems to contradict our common sense. By the way, you don't have to write down everything. You can have the slides, really, because I think it's very hard to write down everything. An evolutionary explanation works only if survival value through generalization from immediate own experience is possible. There must be a survival value to the generalization principle. So how can innate mental capacities that were selected for their immediate adaptive value, how can these capacities be capable of generating true theories about a law-governed natural order that there was no adaptive need to understand earlier? I'm sure that human beings could survive without understanding string theory, for example, and other theories as well, as we have heard yesterday in David Hill's talk, I think. By correcting inconsistencies in appearances and beliefs with reference to conflicting appearances from other perceivers, for example, via language, it's possible to learn from experience. So this might be a route to lead up to that. If we think that there is a possibility to correct inconsistencies in our appearances, like spotting an oasis in the desert, which is caused by a wrong perception. But he says this is an unlikely assumption. The biological origin of the capacity for non-perceptual representation through language and through grasping logically abstract structures, this is just very, very unlikely that language and everything should just come about because of natural fitness. He says that this is a just-so story. It's the same just-so story as that is often heard about moral realism. Why do we believe in objective values? That story starts from innate desires and aversions, like I'm attracted to something or I'm pushed away from something because of an immediate value that we feel. And these are generalized into future experiences and those of others. He says that all this is impossible without language, without interpersonal communication, with abstract concepts, and with a cultural memory. So it starts by adaption. So there is some value in explaining the whole thing by evolutionary theory, but it arrives in areas that are independent of an increase in fitness value. And all this is governed by genotypic variation. And he says this is very far-fetched evolutionary speculation. So what is reason doing? Reason enables us to take an attitude towards our perceptions and to think, are they reliable or not? Towards our appetites and towards our reasons and attitudes. So we can even reason about our reason. To respond to systematic reasons which in themselves justify our conclusions. The problem with evolutionary theory is that reasons are only justified because of external reasons, because they increase fitness value. That's the reason why reason evolves and arrives at higher truth, so to say.
Does he use the word reason here or cause?
I think he uses reason here. Okay. But I would have to look up every sentence there, but I'm pretty sure he... evolutionary causes.
Exactly.
Okay, you meant that. Okay, yeah. It's causes then, yeah. So reason derives its authority normally not from biological or cultural origins. Reason is actually a direct apprehension of truth, not because of an increased fitness value or any other criterion from outside. So why can we rely on vision and reason? And he says there is a difference. Perception, as such, can be recognized as being mistaken, because perception is always indirect. You are not directly in touch with the door over there, but you are only in touch via your senses. And your senses can be fooled, of course, because of interpreting in your brain processing the light waves that come here and the photons in a wrong way, like when you go in the desert and see an oasis where there is no oasis, for example. On the other hand, he says reflection and reasoning is a direct apprehension of truth. It can, of course, also be mistaken, but that's because you don't reason correctly. So there is not an indirect grasp on reality, but it is a direct grasp of logical truths and values. So he says there is a big problem on how you can get from the appearances to reason. And the evolutionary account presupposes reason's validity, but can't confirm it without circularity. Because you always need to say reason arrives at truth because it increases fitness value, and fitness value again defines how reason arrives there, because fitness value is the criterion and the truth to which you need to adapt. So it's a circular reasoning. I hope I could somehow show that to you. So, but reason has completely general validity rather than merely local utility. It's going much beyond our adaptive value or our adaptive capacities. It can neither be confirmed nor undermined by any theory of its evolutionary origin. So if you change the evolutionary theory, then you would still use the same reasoning. So he says its value, its truth value, is independent of whatever history you give to reason. Reason is valid in itself. Reason is justified by reason alone and not by any other criterion. That's the most important take-home message from that, I would say. So, number two, nature of reason. Why can reason lead us beyond appearances to objective truth? He compares perception and reason again, and he says that perception is governed by truth-preserving algorithm. That's why perception usually is reliable. There is an algorithm that preserves truth. But reason, on the other hand, can see that this algorithm is truth-preserving. So it's reasoning about reasoning, so to say. It's again the other perspective. And he says this is a direct grasp on reality. So how can we arrive at a freedom from innate dispositions and our conditioning by our environment and our history, being governed by our perceptions, appetites, emotions, motivations, and so on? Reason can override all of these. We can make any decision and change our life completely from one second to another without being conditioned or anything. You could decide right now to jump out of the window or do whatever you want to. Not flying back home, but flying to Brazil or whatever. So why should reason have the capacity to override other evolved instincts if all instincts simply evolved by natural selection? What makes reason so special about all this? And why are we able to shift from first person to third person in the process of self-awareness and make the subjective appearance into objective reality and truth? So a theory of everything needs to explain that first there are mind-independent objective truths, factual ones, which would be the scientific realm, logic ones, which would be mathematics, philosophy, and so on, and moral values. All these are independent, mind-independent objective truths that can be discovered by mind. Second, individual appearances are transcended by reason into justified beliefs about reality. Third, beliefs directly influence our actions. We will come to that later. And fourth, mental processes are inseparable from physical processes because all our thinking occurs in our brain. So these four ingredients must be explained by any scenario. I will make that shorter a bit. The reductive causal scenario just fails again because we don't arrive at a unified thinking entity. That's the problem. The computer analogy only accounts for input-output behavior, but not for insight or understanding. The emergent causal scenario has another problem, because reason is an irreducible new faculty of a conscious mind. It can't be analyzed into mental parts like sensation and so on, and the level of complexity of a conscious brain must therefore account for reason, if reason is not just a side effect like an epiphenomenon. But the causal route to emergence is very, very improbable by chance, as he says. So why should nature arrive at this complex thing called reason that we use all the time? Emergence seems to favor a teleological scenario, so not governed by causes only, but by a telos, by a goal that wants to be arrived at, so to say, or that somehow works in nature. Then the intentional stance, he says that life looks so much as though it is the product of intentional design, but this would imply several additional assumptions about the motives of a designer and about what kind of things a designer might want to design. And hence, this is all unscientific, all these intentional speculations and assumptions. And then there is the teleological stance. It says a natural bias that favors certain outcomes over others based on increase in value through expanded possibilities. Like you expand the possibilities, you select them, and you arrive at new outcomes. And these principles somehow, by not time-dependent laws that are non-deterministic, lead the causal processes to arrive at those larger goals, guiding laws. So teleological laws, they require that physical laws are not deterministic because then there is nothing to select for by guiding principles. And out of possible futures, some must be more eligible than others as steps forward towards complex systems. For example, via higher probabilities or higher velocities in a certain direction to certain outcomes, a self-organization towards the telos. And he summarizes, I am not confident that this Aristotelian idea of teleology without intention makes sense, but I do not at the moment see why it does not. So he's very honest about his own suspicions about all that, but he just always shows, I'm more suspicious about the other alternatives than I am about mine. And so why does no one follow on my alternative way? Okay, so cognition is a cosmic accident, but improbable. Divine intervention would mean that matter only provides the physical possibility, which is the constitutive part of it, but the outcomes are actually brought about by intentional action, by someone interfering with nature, not by natural principle. So historically, that would mean that nucleic acids of DNA are just like the metals to the nucleic acids are to the DNA and to life, just like what metals are to an airplane. The actualize this, this would need a designer, someone who puts together matter. Matter allows for the physical possibility, but it can't bring it about. You need a designer to put that together. That would be the divine intervention thing. But he says even a theist could agree that the designer applied teleological principles in nature without additional divine intervention. This would be teleological naturalism with or without a designer. So he says a theist could even agree with that, but this God would not be important to that, because the teleological principles are the driving force behind them. Okay, let's come to the final chapter, because before we come to the conclusion, value. I represented value by money, which we have heard this morning, we should not be greedy yet. So value is just showing that there is something to matter that transcends matter. When you write a number on a certain kind of paper, suddenly you get a lot of other matter for that. If you don't write that number there and don't have a certain stamp there, you don't get more matter for that. So value somehow is different from matter. Does value exist? And where does it come from? In his view, value in nature comes from a goal towards which things tend, which is actually teleology. Prerequisites for relevance are that there is consciousness and cognition in order to understand that there are values. If there are no beings that possess consciousness or cognition, there is no possibility to understand value, and so on. And it goes beyond the problem of consciousness and cognition, because it deals with the realm of the control of action. Values provide reasons for action and not causes for action. And he says there is a basic problem that first has to be solved, because there are two views. One view is the value realist view, which he himself holds, and the other one is the value subjectivism. He says that Hume's subjectivism allows for anti-realist versions of moral objectivism and interpersonal justification. Value realism would mean that values really do exist, and value subjectivism would say that values only arise in our subjective experience due to our conditioning and working of our functions. But in subjectivism, moral truth depends only on motivational disposition and our responses to them. In realism, our responses try to reflect a moral truth that is out there, and our responses can be correct or incorrect. There is an objective right answer to that, which is not true for subjectivism. So, how can we go about that? What do we experience? He says, there is a basic level of experiences, which is, for example, pain and pleasure. In this case, reality and appearance coincide. When you feel pain, you say, oh, that's a bad thing to happen, and you feel aversion. So in basic experience, like pain and pleasure, attraction and aversion, reality and appearance coincide. When you have more complex experiences, like knowing that in the future something will happen when I do something now, then this becomes more difficult. And also when you take into account the experiences of other beings, be it human beings or animals or whatever, and also when there are conflicting values in ethical situations. So subjectivism would say in those complex experiences, we arrive at values by prudential judgment of a calm passion of impartial self-interest, which is all centered around our personal functioning. How does our perception work, so to say, and our cognition? It goes beyond instincts and instinctive emotions, but it's all about our functioning. And benefit and harm for me and others could be taken into account, but it's only about our functioning. And it's true only if there is a calm operation. If the operation is not calm, then it would be probably just a reaction out of anger or something. So there are some hints to that. There is some interpersonal communicable truth to it, but it's always dependent on our biology, actually. In the realist view, the truth of values and moral is independent of disposition. It is correct if disposition is in accord with the actual structure of value. So to impose harm on someone else for my own benefit means that I can never disregard the harm of others. Never. No matter how my processes in my brain work. Because there is more to it than just the functioning of my appreciation of values. Okay, so value realism denies that all truth is only natural, mathematical, or psychological. A value judgment is true by value itself, again, not by anything else. And value itself can be experienced. We experience value as reasons for our actions. He admits a problem, that there is no experiment to decide between realism and subjectivism. The only thing that isn't a good argument is the fruitfulness of moral thought. But there is no experiment to decide between the two. So he says, yeah, if you're a materialist, you could always come up with that argument against my argument here. Because it's only a comparison between two alternative explanations. But if you think that values really exist and are to some degree objective, then you must probably follow my argument. So he says, Darwinian evolution implies subjectivism. There is no way to arrive at moral objective values. Because values only arise as a consequence of fitness value. It's a pre-reflective impression of value. The impression of badness of pain enhances fitness by avoiding injury. Yeah, I experience pain and hence I avoid this because it hurts. But what actually enhances my fitness value is that I avoid the injury that would have happened without the pain, sitting on a hot stove, for example. But value itself is an illusion because it only results from the survival value. Pain itself has no value. I don't know what Peter told in his talk about pain, but we could come to that later. Yeah, and he actually follows the argument by Sharon Street. She's of the same opinion and says Darwinian evolution implies subjectivism. And she says Darwinism is true and therefore value realism is wrong. And Thomas Nagel says, no, it's the other way around. Value realism is true, so Darwinism must be false. It's very interesting that they come from different views and say, I believe this is true, I believe that is true, but they are incompatible and hence the other one might be wrong. And that's the way how Sharon Street has influenced his work. So how do we arrive at values? Can we take desire and aversion as a starting point? But there must be more. There must be a survival value and biological function to all that. And the objects, and there must be objects of reflective consciousness. And these objects, they somehow begin from the value of pleasure and the pain and of pain. And they go on to systematic recognition of reasons in more complex experiences, and they even lead up to moral principles. Such objects of reflective consciousness, which means we need consciousness and we need cognition as prerequisites in order to detect value. And if the existence of B, that there are no objects of reflective consciousness, if this can be refuted and it can be explained by Darwinian mechanisms, then he says value realism would be refuted, though it's falsifiable. Because values are true only because of something, because then values are only true because of something else and not because of the values themselves. So how can value be detected? How can we experience that there is value? He says it can be detected by the motivation of human actions. For example, basic experiences, if you experience pleasure, you have the desire to continue. So you continue to eat chocolate cream, for example. Or pain. If you feel pain, you have the desire to stop. But it can also be motivated by absent experiences, like motivated by the recognition that pain is bad, for example, because of future experiences or because of the experiences of other beings. And this might even be such a strong motivation that you can resist even present pleasure in order to avoid future pain, for example. Complex experiences might lead up, therefore, to honesty, to justice, and to loyalty, and so on. And reasons for action actually are an ordinary fact. We are all aware that we just don't only go into action because of causes, but because of reasons. And reasons count for or against doing something. This implies free will, by the way. So we are consciously responding to value and choose action. Reasons affect behavior of value-sensitive agents, which is us. Our behavior is affected by reasons. So reason, in his view, is not just a supplementary explanation, but it's a basic explanation that is not reducible to others. What does that mean? Action is explained by three different components: by our physiological conditions, by our conscious conditions like desires and so on, but also by judgments that are oriented according to values, for example. So consciousness, cognition, and values in this view are not epiphenomena, but play an active role. So in his view, every reductive explanation is unlikely because we need a unified subject who can respond to reasons. What about the emergent explanations for this? Historical, subjectivism could have arisen by Darwinism, as we have heard already, and value realism is something like Darwinism plus X. And X means that we are able to consciously control our actions responding to reasons and not just because of fitness value processes that are genetically determined. So how do we arrive there? First, we need to say that life is a good that can be lost. Also, the proper functioning of life can be lost if you have a disease or something or are hurt. Then second, the arrival of conscious beings. And their experiential lives can go well or they can go badly. Then a capacity for reasoning, to recognize reasons as motives, and a capacity for collective reasoning, a good and bad beyond myself, beyond my first person experience, which would just be subjective reasons, but a collective reasoning, which means there are objective reasons. And this leads up to two things that have to be explained. First, the appearance of value, and second, the appearance of beings that are capable of recognizing reasons for action. I abbreviate that now. The historical emergent explanation would be like that. If you take only the causal picture, then values are only an accident. And in his view, that simply does not fit our experience. Then intentional stance, he already argued about that, he will leave that aside because of the unified natural order. And then what is only left is the teleological alternative, which says that the natural order has a propensity towards the existence of beings for which things can be good or bad. And he says that actually value is pluralistic because we as human beings have our objective values. But the perspective of a bee or a lion might be completely different. For example, on is it good to eat a human being or not? So he says nature actually must account for a tendency for proliferation of variety. But value itself cannot be an accident, but the telos, it must be the telos that guides evolution. So this is actually part of his teleological force, is value itself. Life and consciousness exist as necessary conditions for value to arrive and to be experienced or detected. So how does he evaluate the chances for his theory? And he says, in the present intellectual climate, such a possibility is unlikely to be taken seriously. But I would repeat my earlier observation that no viable account, even a purely speculative one, seems to be available of the origin of life. So he says, if you accuse me of speculating and attacking you, I will say you are also speculating and you have no solution for the origin of life, which my new paradigm might contribute a solution to. And he says, this is not only religious people like intelligent design people, but he also quotes Francis Crick, who says that the arrival of life would just almost be a miracle. So he says, everything is speculation, not only my view. So this is no argument against my paradigm, because science needs to take into account different roots, different perspectives. To understand reason and value, we must reject the chance plus natural selection hypothesis in his view. So we transcend the imperatives of biology, A, by theoretical reason, which is determining the real structure of the world, which is actually cognition, like understanding the world in science and so on, beyond pure sense perception. And second, by practical reasoning, values as motivation for our action and not just as illusion. And he ends this chapter by, and I have to acknowledge that for someone not disposed to accept value realism, the radical consequences I have drawn from it will only increase its implausibility. So that's actually a good joke that he's making there, by admitting that someone who is not disposed to accept that has not the ability to reason about that, so he has no choice. He just can't accept it because he's disposed to that. It's not about truth value, but about disposition. And that's actually summing up his whole argument in that one joke, I think. So he comes to the conclusion. Philosophy is the comparison of alternatives. That's an interesting definition, I think. It's not about conclusive proof or refutation, but it's about comparison of alternatives. In the present climate of a dominant scientific naturalism, heavily dependent on speculative Darwinian explanations of practically everything, and armed to the teeth against attacks from religion, I have thought it useful to speculate about alternatives. So that's all. It's not about proofs or refutations. It's just about you are really not plausible. You don't have a plausible paradigm. Just think about mine. So he says that it is unclear whether we don't know yet or whether we never can know. And of course, we always need to be aware that there is the possibility of the error, or that the basic problem is the error of reducing the mental to the physical. That's the point where he started from. So now two interesting quotations. He says that the current paradigm is actually a heroic triumph of ideological theory over common sense. I bet the present right-thinking consensus will come to seem laughable in a generation or two. The human will to believe is inexhaustible. And he also says it would be an advance if the secular theoretical establishment could wean itself off, like that's when you remove a baby from the breast of the mother, could wean itself off the materialism and Darwinism of the gaps. So I think he intends this religious language here somehow. This approach is incapable of providing an adequate account, either constitutive or historical, and now you understand what constitutive and historical means, of our universe. Okay, it's clear that such a book will be discussed. And so some comments about some arguments, and most of the responses, especially in the Anglo-American world, were very critical about him. And not only about his thoughts, but also about his person, as I indicated in the beginning. So some people say he just attacks a straw man by misrepresenting science, except Dawkins and Dennett. They are radicals within the scientific realm. Science is not as reductionist as he claims, and actually science accepts independence of mental phenomena. They would just, maybe according to Duhigg or such people, who say there are different areas. But still one could think that Nagel is just taking that to the end. If everything is only matter, and you think that to the end, you still must ask the question, where does mind come from? Okay, I will soon be finished. And then they say he underestimates the evidence for evolution and overestimates the unique nature of consciousness, which is still dependent on a physical brain. This is, of course, the argument with Sharon Street, like, what is true, Darwinism or value realism, and both of them are incompatible. But, of course, monism is presupposed in that counter-argument, if you say that mind is definitely not beyond nature and matter. And then, this is a very interesting argument, Nagel is the real reductionist by insisting on a comprehensive theory of everything that explains everything from Big Bang to consciousness just by one guiding principle, for example. But you could again counter-argue and say, if materialism is true, this should in principle be possible. As a rationalist, Nagel searches for a principle that makes the appearance of mind probable. Empiricists can live with improbable things becoming more and more probable in the course of evolution. So we don't need a governing principle, but it's just step by step evolutionary stepping up the ladder, so to say. And there doesn't have to be any principle. It could just be random step, and save the different steps somehow. Nagel gives momentum to religious opponents of evolution. This is probably the core of all the criticism against him, because he even says that ID proponents deserve our gratitude. But he clearly himself distances himself from religion and says he's averse to it, as in the footnote. He argues from ignorance and offers no real alternative but speculation about an esoteric natural teleological force. So he says speculation is in all alternatives, and probably he's right about that. And he rejects theism only on grounds of his own presuppositions and does not deal adequately with it. This is, of course, a Christian criticism of him. And the root for that is his insistence on a unified natural order. His persuasion is that nature is self-contained. And he doesn't see mind as an argument against that. So, there are arguments in support of Nagel, and especially the Catholic philosopher Ed Fieser wrote a 10-part blog, which is worth reading, but it's quite lengthy. All of these 10 parts have several dozens of pages. Nagel definitely reveals the weaknesses of materialism. If it is stretched from a working assumption to a comprehensive explanation of the world. For example, Ed Fieser gives the example, scientists argue that metal detectors have been successful in finding metal objects, and hence they are the only source for our knowledge about metal objects. Which of course is not true, because the color of metal objects and everything could not be measured or detected by metal detectors. So that's the analogy he uses. I like that one. And then Nagel reveals that materialism is necessarily reductionistic, though most scientists might not explicitly reduce everything to material processes. But it is necessarily reductionistic. Then he exposes chance as an insufficient explanation for the origin of consciousness, reason, and value. So for example, the noise of a machine is an epiphenomenon. When the machine is running, you just hear a noise. But is that also true for a radio? A radio exists precisely because of the sound. So the sound of the radio is definitely not an epiphenomenon of that machine, but it's the cause, the purpose for the radio to exist. He exposes how an evolutionary explanation undermines the objectivity of our rationality and of our morality on the other side by subordinating them to fitness value instead of truth. And I think this is probably the strongest argument in this whole book. And then, of course, Nagel just shows personal courage. Who would dare to write such a book, actually? I don't know who would. And Nagel shows enormous courage going against the flow. So I close with a German quotation. And you can just see by the words that I have underlined, this is the Spektrum der Wissenschaft from Germany, actually, which is a naturalistic scientific magazine, popular magazine. And I just thought, what book have they read to some degree? Because they say that all the conflict about evolutionary theory is often led with much hardness and ideological ideological capturedness. You can't just think about something else. It is very delightful that Thomas Nagel in his book has written a completely unideological book and that he very calmly analyzes the problems. And he does not use polemics at all, which I think he does. But I don't know which book they have read, or maybe they skipped over some pages. It would be a great advance, playing on the expression that Thomas Nagel uses himself, if all participants in this discussion, especially the scientists, would orient themselves at his style. Well, I don't know. He's sometimes very aggressive, but of course he gets things to the point. Yeah, so you see that different people react differently. And in Germany, there are quite a few anti-reductionists, but they would not be theists at the same time. And so quite a few people really welcomed that book. It was great. So I think his argument definitely poses a strong challenge to materialism as a skeptic atheistic witness who says, I still am an atheist, definitely, and I won't change. And it depends on the evaluation, of course. Is the weight of success of reductive science stronger, or the common sense experience of subjectivity, rationality, and morality? And while this argument challenges materialism, it does not necessarily lead to faith in God, but also opens doors for other paradigms like natural teleology and so on. Pantheism. And I thought about what might Paul might ask, what might he ask Nagel? He might ask him, is nature really a closed system? Is there a unified natural order that is responsible for everything from the Big Bang to my existence? How can personality and intentionality arise from non-personality and non-intentionality? How can objective values be effective without a personal agent behind these values? What kind of being can determine objective value in a plurality of living beings? What is your problem with nature being a work of an independent God, creating man in his own image, able to think, to judge, to act, create in this world too? Why couldn't that be the larger picture and not just a unified natural picture? Well, I don't know what he would answer about that. I just leave that for the general discussion, reminding you of the different chapters there. And yeah, sorry, I stretched your minds quite a bit, I think. But I tried to really dig into that book, and I find it hard to understand, but I hope I could give you the basic ideas about the book.